Hello and welcome to the Ropescast, the independent voice of the Middle East. I'm Ksenia Svitlova.
And I'm Ibrahim Abu Ahmed. ROPE stands for the Regional Organization for Peace, Economics and Security. We are working towards a post-conflict Middle East by connecting forward-thinking Israeli and Palestinian emerging leaders with like-minded peers from across the region and promoting peaceful resolution and regional integration. If you're looking for more information on ROPES, please visit our website, ropes.org.
Our special guest today is John Aziz. He is a British-Palestinian writer, musician, and peace advocate. His work has appeared in The Atlantic and Foreign Policy. Hello, John, and welcome to the Ropescast.
Hi there. Thank
Great
you for having
to have
me.
You with us.
Pleasure to have you with us.
So, John, I would like to ask you, you know, as far as I know, you are a musician, but me and also many people, I think like thousands by now, many thousands, know you from Twitter and also from your Thoughtwood articles in The Atlantic and Foreign Policy and other publications. So how did that happen? And also, if you can just like, you know, tell us a little bit about yourself, where you were born, where you were raised, and this kind of stuff.
So I'm a British Palestinian. I'm half, you know, white British and half West Bank Palestinian. My father is from the West Bank. I was born in the UK. I visited Palestine, specifically the West Bank, three times. Most recently, over a decade ago, unfortunately, I don't really like going back when there's the military occupation and I have to go through all these checkpoints and so on and so forth. And I understand that, you know, that's a big strain for Palestinians living there. I got into this. I sort of was interested in the conflict, right? I had kind of pro-peaceful views. I thought certainly, you know, based upon reading books and trying to talk to people on both sides of the conflict, I thought neither side's going anywhere. You know, Palestinians have been there for hundreds of years, and of course, the Jewish connection to the land is very old and ancient. So it was never going to be that there was going to be one side being, you know, completely victorious over the other and kind of wiping the other out. I don't think that's going to happen. So I've always been interested in pro-peaceful views, and I was, you know, deeply upset after the October the 7th because I knew it would lead to a war like the one we're seeing in Gaza today now. And obviously I was, you know, terribly upset by the suffering on that day. I'm terribly upset by the ongoing conflict and all civilian deaths in Gaza. And I was sort of tweeting, you know, at a small level with a few, you know, a few hundred followers. Some of my tweets talking about it got some traction. And then, you know, within, you know, a few days I had The Atlantic asking me to write for them, which was quite unexpected, to be quite honest. You know, I thought that, you know, I might get a few retweets and I thought I might get a few new followers, you know, from some of my tweets going a bit viral. I think I was predominantly at that point, I was talking about, you know, where is the movement for peace in Palestine among Palestinians? And, you know, how do we collectively as Israelis and Palestinians kind of advance to the kind of peaceful, respectful, coexistent solution that I think a lot of people on both sides really want to have, because they recognize, as I do, that neither people is going anywhere. We're not going to push the other one out. So it's much better to, you know, forego all of the slaying and all of the war and all the bombing and terrorism and hostages, and instead to have a peaceful solution where we live together peacefully.
So, you know, unfortunately, I would say in our world that it's becoming so polarized, these messages that you're bringing that are peaceful messages, talking about moving forward, like you said, as Israelis and Palestinians, in the pro-Palestinian camp, particularly in the West and certainly in the UK, it's very unpopular and it's very unaccepted opinions, since the opinions are becoming so polarized. So what kind of responses are you getting from the pro-Palestinian community in the UK, the Palestinian community itself in the UK, maybe your family in the West Bank? What are the responses like?
I mean, I think that there are Palestinians who agree with me. You know, I can name some of them. You know, Ahmed Fouad al-Khatib, Hamza Abu Huwaidi. No, there's multiple people on Twitter who are sort of in my camp, which I suppose is the peace camp in Palestinian politics. Many of them are expats. Many of them are like, they've fled the conflict, and I think that there is an element of intimidation in places like Gaza. Obviously, it's very explicit that people who are defined as collaborators, even if they haven't collaborated at all with the Israeli government, even if they haven't participated in any sort of activity with the Israeli government, they may, face, potentially imprisonment, potentially death. And there's also an element of intimidation in the West Bank too. It's not quite as, explicit and strong-armed as in Gaza, but certainly people who are accused of being collaborators can face very, very serious, deadly consequences. The response in Britain is, there's a lot of people who are quite fiery, who see me essentially as being an advocate for Zionism and an advocate for Israel, and trying to excuse, what they perceive as being a genocide against Palestinians. And I think it's quite problematic, really, to try and push me into this box where I'm somehow, Netanyahu's lapdog. I don't I I'm not
no one
I'm not,
wants to be that.
I wouldn't want to be Netanyahu's lapdog, because I don't agree with the policies of Netanyahu. I think there's for the failure to make peace, I think there's responsibility on both sides. Mr. Netanyahu himself is very strident in saying that he wants to claim responsibility as the one who prevented the Palestinian state. And of course, I'm very much in favor of a two-state solution. So of course, I'm not part of that camp at all. I reject that. I want to encourage, an independent Palestinian nation. But that's the pro-Palestine community online and in the UK just wants, as you say, it's polarization. They just want, in so many cases, not everyone, but so many people just want to put you into a box and say, you're supporting Hasbara, you're supporting Israel. Mm-hmm. And I think it makes it a lot more difficult to really have these conversations that we need to have about reconciliation between the two sides and coexistence between the two sides, because you can't base everything upon delegitimizing one side. And we do see this on both sides. Of course, there are Kahanists and people on the right and, the far right in Israel, whose position is essentially Palestinians are not a country, they're not a people, they need to go to Jordan and they should be happy there. And obviously at the same time, there are people, Western leftists and pro-Palestinians and Palestinians themselves, whose position is that that Zionism is somehow completely illegitimate and all of the Jews need to go back to Europe, which is it's ethnic cleansing. So it's frustrating that there are extremists on both sides who are trying to push back against people like me, who really, really, what I want to be associated with is the peace movement and advocating for coexistence, and some people find that hard to deal with.
My next question is exactly, it's a continuation basically of this discussion, because in the music community, we saw how many, first of all, this world was hugely polarized immediately, even before, I think, the 10/7. And this is, of course, it goes back to Roger Waters and the issue of boycotting Israel, performing in Israel, not performing in Israel. But now it's like very, like in general music world and also the Hollywood world, it's very divided, like you're pro-Palestine and you are pro-Israel. Did you, and you get canceled by the, those who believe on, the something different that you are representing and believing. Did something like this happen to you? Did you experience it, you or your friends?
I will say, in terms of my music career, I am nowhere near as famous as Roger Waters, and we wish you
to be even more famous.
I don't think honestly my experiences, I'm right now I'm a university student, and my band is currently in the process of making an album, and that's kind of, we're kind of at the start of our of our career, right? So I'm hoping that once we get around to finishing these recordings, we'll be able to release them without all this controversy and people saying horrible things about the music because they don't like me or they don't like my opinion. And I think that in terms of the kind of message I want to put out, I want to associate myself with people like John Lennon and people like Jimi Hendrix, whose vision was peace and coexistence, and people from different backgrounds and different communities being able to come together and accept each other as human beings and stop the violence, right? That's what I want to be an advocate for. So I'm that's that and I, that's what I would much prefer my music to be associated with. But I went into this whole argument, this whole debate about the war and the history of the Holy Land, and that unfortunately does put a bit of a target on your back. So we'll see, I suppose. But I'm not my music isn't our music isn't particularly political, even. It's psychedelic rock, really. So it's not I'm not even putting a peace sign on the album cover and saying, this music is to promote peace between Israel and Palestinians. No, that
Music is music per se.
music is music, yeah. But in my heart, my message is one of peace. That's the that to me that's the ultimate truth here, is that we can't escape from, is that the conflict will continue until people on both sides can open their hearts and accept that peace is the answer.
And we of course agree. And talking about your message of peace, you wrote for the Atlantic, as you said, and you wrote for the Atlantic. And there was one article that was titled, "All My Life, I Watched the Violence Fail the Palestinian Cause." Can you elaborate on how violence have failed the Palestinians, even
Well,
before October 7th?
yeah, I mean the if we go back to the origins of the conflict, and it's a whole controversial topic as to where did the conflict originate from, but certainly the War of Independence between in 1948 between the Arab states and Israel, that I certainly the events that gave that gave rise to that included pogroms and massacres. There was plenty of stuff that happened to result in there needing to be a partition between the two sides. It wasn't that there was just one country and everyone was living happily together. There were reasons why the UN came up with a partition plan, and it included some quite severe violence. So it failed the Arab Palestinian side then, and it worked quite well on the other hand for the Yishuv and what became the State of Israel. There was a violent conflict. One side came out on top. So that was, one time, not within my lifetime, but in the origins of the conflict, where violence didn't work for the Palestinian side. And there have been many subsequent wars, right? 1956, 1967, 1973. Israel has done very well at coming out on top in these conflicts, and the Palestinians have, suffered the majority of the casualties, the majority of the destruction, or should I say, the Palestinians and the Arab side, and the majority of the land losses, right? So it's a bitter pill to swallow, probably, for Palestinians to accept that we've had by far the worst time of this. But and on the other hand, the right wing, in Israel, a lot of them are probably, very happy with this, and probably would, some of them will be happy for it to continue, because it means expansion of their kind of pan-Zionist dream of a greater Israel. So there's a difficult pills to swallow for everyone here. But I certainly think that the resorting to violence in terms of expressing Palestinian national identity has basically not succeeded. And the only time where maybe there was some success would have been the first Intifada, which eventually led to the Oslo process. But of course, the Oslo process ended up failing, And it failed, you know, with the advent of the second Intifada, where I suppose what happened is that Arafat didn't particularly like the offer he had at Camp David. And there was a choice among the leadership in Fatah to, you know, kind of let's try and get more pressure or more leverage on Israel with the second Intifada. And there's, I think, you know, I think there's confirmation from Arafat's widow that he authorized the initiation of the second Intifada with Hamas at that point. And this is really where things fell to pieces. And, you know, Israelis ended up with 20 years of Bibi, and Palestinians ended up with a blockade in Gaza and, you know, the continued occupation of the West Bank. And so once again, what I would advocate for is a return to something like Oslo, and we accept an offer this time. You know, both sides have to accept an offer. Both sides have to compromise, because the cost, you know, the price of achieving peace on both sides surely is compromise. We have to both come out of this looking like we've won to some extent. And, you know, that's where we need to go. So there's been a terrible tendency to resort to violence, and that hasn't worked for Palestinians at all.
And following up on that, and you just mentioned Oslo here, I mean, if violence really have failed us, always failed us, would you say the same thing about peace failing us all our lives?
If violence had really failed us, or do you mean if violence had succeeded?
Like the violence did not work. Do you think that also attempting peace also didn't work?
Okay. So. Right. No, I see what your question is. So the attempts to reach peace have also failed. Yes. I mean, they have. And I think one of the factors is that there has been insufficient willingness on both sides to compromise. I think probably there's also been insufficient vision. Right. I think there has been a fundamental failure, certainly on my side, but probably also on the Israeli side, to really reckon with the legitimacy and the reality of the other side's narratives, right? Like if you go onto Twitter, you'll hear on the Palestinian side, you'll hear people saying, you know, Zionism's a fraud, Zionism's fake, or, you know, people get into these weird conspiracy theories, like the European Jews are Khazars, or however you pronounce that. You know, there's extreme delegitimization, certainly from my side, and probably, you know, well, almost certainly from the other side of each other. So if we can't really reckon with who we are and where we came from and where both sides came from, then are we really going to be able to achieve peace? You know, I want to achieve peace as much as anyone else, you know, but yes, there has been a lot of failure to achieve peace, and we need to work past that, and we need to work through it. And I think the first step towards that is, you know, saying very, very clearly, we want to live in peace. That's what we want. That's where we have to get to, and saying it again and again and again and again and again until people start listening.
Well, in this regard, I think that, you know, the BDS movement, and you write quite a lot about them, clearly, you know, it's a movement in the wrong direction, you know, because their theory is that if only they will boycott and divest and, you know, make, you know, musicians not come to Israel and companies stay away from Israel, then somehow, you know, the peace will come, because, you know, it would be forced on people. But do you think that it's even feasible to force peace on the people who don't
this
want
is
it?
This is what I hear from my Palestinian critics all the time, right? One of the arguments I've heard the most is, if you want there to be peace, there needs to be leverage, and we need to have some power to lever over Israel. Because the argument is that this conflict is between two very uneven, very asymmetric sides. Of course, Israel is a successful country. Its GDP per capita has exceeded places like the UK, where I live, and it has nuclear weapons, nuclear submarines. One of the most powerful armies in the world. And on the other side, you have, you know, rocket launches gained from Iran, But really, it's a small paramilitary force, very dug in, which has made it a, you know, this is a very brutal, long, difficult war, but very, very, very asymmetric. So of course, the argument is the Palestinian people are disempowered, therefore they need to have leverage. They need to somehow push Israel into a weaker position so that Israel will accept peace. And I would say that that's not the approach that I want to go with, because my perspective is that actually, and I wrote about this in my foreign policy article, if you're a relatively disempowered people, there are much better tools to get to convince people of your case than either, you know, either violence or, you know, sanctions, force, trying to force people to make peace with you. I think by far the most effective tool we actually have is conversation and trying to reach out with an olive branch. I actually that's the pathway that I am choosing to take of reconciliation, trying to reach a reconciliation, trying to reach a kind of sense that there's a mutual legitimacy. And I at the same time, I don't condemn or rule out you know, using either diplomacy or nonviolent resistance. I think those are legitimate tactics and strategies. But there again, there has been a lot of attempts at this, and you look at something like BDS, for example, and it hasn't actually brought Israel back to the negotiating table, and it hasn't bridged the gap. So I'm trying something different, and some people seem to like what I'm doing. Not, some people on both sides seem to like what I'm doing. So I think that is. It's a different approach, and I think it can be successful because I'm coming from a place of common humanity where I really try to empathize with the other side and really try to understand them and understand where they're coming from, and hope that if I do that, then they can do that to my side, and then we could really have peace. It's about breaking down these mental barriers to peace, as opposed to trying to break down the other side with pressure and sanctions and boycotts.
Just a couple of days ago, there was a very sad and tragic incident here in Jordan Valley when a terrorist shot at two Israelis at the car, and both of them were actually from the peace movement, which is called "Look at the Eyes of the Occupation." Look to the occupation in the eyes. Tistakeli kibush beinayim, you know. And you know, I didn't see many people from the BDS movement lamenting, you know, this incident or expressing sorrow, like, you know, like, oh, you know, they killed the wrong people. No, that they still think that it's a legitimate resistance cause, and you know, that everything basically legitimate, you know, peace activists, settlers, kids, you know, old people, you know, it's whatever.
Right. Yeah. So of course we saw that on October the 7th, and in some of the justifications that were written about it, including by the, you know, Aaron Bushnell, who immolated himself. He wrote a Reddit post talking about, you know, they are all settlers, right? And that this and I know Hassan Piker, another, he's a Twitch streamer, talking about this idea that they're all settlers, that everyone ultimately, you know, whether they're at a music festival, whether they're in some socialist kibbutz, or whether they're, you know, an IDF soldier, they're all settlers, and this is a product of what I was talking about, which is delegitimization and
Well, it's
dehumanization.
the mirror side is it is that you know, some ministers in the Israeli government are saying that, you know, everybody's Hamas. We don't care. Even if they're really anti-Hamas, and even if they fight the Hamas, they still it's still
Of
Hamas.
course, one of my, you know, one of the friends that I've gained in my advocacy, he was a Palestinian, is Ahmed Fouad al-Khatib, and he, you know, he lost large numbers, I think over 30 of his family members, in you know, an IDF bomb on their house. And what really happened there? Did they have the right target, the wrong target? You know, what kind of mistakes were made? You know, I don't know. I hope the IDF will investigate the death of his family, to be quite honest. I hope someone's held responsible for that. But I think it's extremely dangerous to roll all Palestinians into one and say all Palestinians are Hamas. You know, that everyone in Gaza supports Hamas. They're all responsible. I think that's incredibly dangerous. It's the same problem that I keep talking about that affects our own side, where we delegitimize and dehumanize the other side. That's exactly the same problem. If you refuse to look at the humanity of the people in question, then you will end up with situations like civilians becoming targets, you know, people shooting up a music festival, or people, you know, people murdering Vivian Silver, who was a, you know, long-term peace activist, who, you know, she drove guards and children to hospital, right? She would meet them at the crossing and drive them in her car to hospital if they were sick. So that person, you know, however much you might disagree with Netanyahu or Ben-Gvir or Smotrich or anyone in the Israeli government, like Vivian Silver isn't the Israeli government. Just as me or Hamza Abu Hawidi are not members of Hamas. We oppose Hamas, right?
So I had the privilege to know Vivian. She was a part of Women Wage Peace movement. They are partners of Ropes also, and yes, I still cannot get over have not being with us and dying in such a horrible way. As for Ahmed Fuad and Khatib, it's a good opportunity to remind to our listeners that we hosted Ahmed Fuad and Khatib in one of Rope's webinars, not a podcast, but webinars, and it can be found on our YouTube and also, of course, on our website. And so it was very insightful conversation that also included an American and an Israeli, you know, who it was made by 100 days of war. Of course, we hope that, it will not last that long. But now here we are today. We are recording this episode. It's 177th day of the war, and we are still counting.
Which is shocking. It's shocking. It's gone on this long. I mean, I thought it would probably be over more quickly than this. Simply, I didn't realize on the ground quite how dug in Hamas is, because of course there have been occasions where, the IDF captured Al-Shifa Hospital, you know, months ago at this point. But again, yesterday there was another incident, battle, some are calling atrocity, that took place at Al-Shifa Hospital. So you get territory captured, then maybe the IDF withdraw and Hamas move back in. So it's a difficult, long, horrible war. And we, you know, that I chose to use my voice to try and advocate for peace. And that's how I got here. And I want everybody who's listening to this, try and use your voice to advocate for peace as well, in whatever way you can, because we need people who want peace. We're not all going to agree on every issue, right? I don't agree with other Palestinians on every issue. I certainly don't agree with every other Israeli on every issue. But I appreciate it when people will speak up for peace and will say, you know, release the hostages, end the siege, end the occupation, end the war. That's what I want people listening to do, to advocate for peace.
Thank you so much for this call, John. And we, of course, support it in every single way. People who want peace, we want to hear your voices.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
We appreciate you and your voice. And like you said, you know, like Palestinians don't always agree on anything. We have a running joke of Israel. You get two Israelis, you have three opinions. Even in Israel, people disagree all the time. But it's about finding the places where we can agree, all of us, you know? And turning into solutions, we're talking about the problems, right? Looking at solutions, we at Ropes believe in a future where the state of Israel and a future state of Palestine can coexist and thrive together with the rest of the region.
How do you
see the role of the region in ending this ongoing war?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are positive incentives to reach a peaceful agreement, you know, for example, for Israel, there's normalization with Saudi Arabia, which is something that I think the Israeli government wants. I think the government of Saudi Arabia also wants that. And I think one of the conditions they've attached is, you know, self-determination for the Palestinian people. So there's incentives with the region. I think that, you know, places like the UAE, Saudi Arabia, even Qatar, they have experienced the prosperity that comes with peace. And in those places, life is relatively peaceful, and that's a great, opportunity for human beings to thrive. But in where we are, we don't, we're in Israel, Palestine. Peace is it's a long way away because we're locked in this grip between two different peoples, where in inhabiting many of the same places, we're interlocked around each other, but there's no, overarching legal framework like a two-state solution that exists that would give both peoples the kind of self-determination and freedom to thrive and to and so I it's incredibly important that actors across the region will facilitate this in any way they can. I think right now, for example, one of the most important ways they can help after the war is the rebuilding of Gaza. I certainly think that Palestinians do not want the IDF in Gaza, so there could be a security solution offered by external Arab countries, for example, such as signatories to the Abraham Accords. There might be some deal that can be done whereby the IDF will withdraw and the, countries from the Abraham Accords will be providing the security, building towards the framework and the backbone of creating a Palestinian state. And I also think it's incredibly important that, we get back to facilitating, peace negotiations. There needs to be more floated, proposed solutions. Even if they don't go anywhere, there are like the Trump plan, it didn't go anywhere, but at least it was a proposal that we could talk about and that we could say, okay, this is what I would change. This is what I would do better. We need more of those. We need those to come from Arab states, Egypt, UAE, Saudi Arabia, Qatar. If they want to, support peace, these countries, then let's see more roadmaps. Let's see more plans for what the two-state solution would look like, and let's see bankrolling of the reconstruction of Gaza. And it needs we need to think about giving hope. We need to think about giving hope because Hamas preys on people with no hope and no jobs. That's the truth.
Yeah.
That is, there are plenty of rich Western leftists who support Hamas. I'm not denying that. But on the ground, in the refugee camps in Gaza, their biggest recruiting material is having people with too much time on their hands, right? Not enough money, and they offer them an opportunity to make some money, right? They will pay you, and I think that is how Hamas has been recruiting, and ultimately also it gives when people have on the ground in Gaza, when they have when they're living in poverty, when they have a disappointing life, when they don't have many life prospects and job prospects, and 50%, 60% unemployment, youth unemployment. They give the people there someone to blame. They say blame Israel. So of course, Hamas is the government of Gaza, and I know Hamas probably couldn't. They couldn't solve every problem in Gaza, even if they wanted to.
But they
But
didn't even try.
they instead what they gave people was someone to blame. They gave Hamas said, "You can blame Israel for all of your problems. Come and join us." Right? That's that, and I think it's incredibly important. If we really want to have peace, that we move from the mindset of who to blame to the question of what to do to fix our problems.
On the question of whom to blame, I have my last question to you. We are coming to the end of our conversation, but I cannot resist it because you are half British and you live in the UK. So, many people say that, the West created these problems. The West drew the borders of the Middle East today as we know them. And specifically Britain, I mean, come on, they were involved with the neck, with all of our original problems and so on. So shouldn't they be the ones who would offer solutions and push really hard, for all of that?
I think so, right? I think if Britain and the West want to play a constructive role in fixing the problem, then we should absolutely welcome that, right? I reach out with both of my hands to Britain and America, because I think they have strong interests in the region. Britain certainly has some role in failing to leave us with a situation that was peaceful. I think you can put some blame on Britain. You can't put all the blame on Britain. I mean, the borders today are not actually the ones that Britain left us with. They were determined by the wars, but I mean, they were somewhat influenced by the situation that
Yeah,
Britain
but them, living without a proper solution and just expecting for
Yeah.
people when it was clear that the war will break out in 48 was kind of irresponsible. But then again, this is material for yet another podcast about
Britain,
how we
Britain
can
should
together blame Britain for all of our troubles.
Britain should absolutely be a mediator towards solving this. Yes, I would strongly advocate for that, and I think Britain is fairly neutral compared to some countries, right? I think Britain probably does have the best interests of both at heart, and probably also some responsibility for things going so wrong. So yes, I think Britain should be involved.
All right, John Aziz, thank you very much. It was great having you with us.
Thank you
And let's
both. I've
just repeat again, people that want peace, we want to hear your voice, just as like John said.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate you and appreciate your work. It's
Thank you.
so
I
difficult at these
appreciate
times.
your work.
You're a
Thank
hero.
you. Thank you. Thank you.
Bye-bye, John.
Thank you for inviting me on. Have a great day. All the best. Take care.
All the best.
You
Bye.
too.
Take care. You've been listening to The Ropes Cast, the independent voice of the Middle East. Our guest today was John Aziz, a British Palestinian, a musician, a writer, and a columnist.
We hope you enjoyed The Ropes Cast. Our podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, and all quality podcast platforms. We are very grateful to all our listeners from the Middle East, Europe, and the United States, and other parts of the world. You can support our work by small donation. More information on our website, ropes.org. We also invite you to follow ropes.org on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and Threads to find out more about our work with the emergent leaders of the Middle East. I'm Ibrahim Abu Ahmad.
And I'm Ksenia Svetlova.
Shalom.
And salam.